My name is Ed Goldberg, and I am speaking to Richard Weirich. Richard is the author of Kicking In, a book of stories, and it's published by Soft Skull Press. Rick, welcome to Cable and welcome to Portland.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Ed.
It's good to have you here. This is a book of short stories, and I understand novels. I understand how a novel is constructed, how it's paced, what the components of a novel are, but I've never been able to get what a short story is, especially one that's not like an O. Henry short story that has, you know, a punchline at the end. What is the concept of a short story the way you see it?
It's funny. Norman Mailer once said at a reading I was at, he said, you know, the novel is like a marriage. The short story is like a one-night stand. It does really kind of galvanize the energies and attentions of the reader. You got to grab them, I think, you know, much quicker than you do with a novel. You don't have the luxury of that, you know, building up a history, and you don't have a lot of latitude with character development. But there's all, you know, there's all kinds of stories. In first person stories are mostly voice driven. You know, Faulkner was such a genius at that. And then when I think certain writers and certain voices and points of view can be quite good and quite bad, and with other points of view, like I don't think Faulkner wrote that well in the third person. But he definitely was a novelist, not a short story writer. The short story, you know, came into its own really in the mid-19th century in the magazines, when people needed to read something that was intellectually enriching but didn't have time to follow the serializations of the big novels, especially in Russia and England. And, you know, of course, Poe, Baudelaire, and Hawthorne, they were the masters. So I think to answer your question is just it requires tremendous compression and you know, a lot of discipline, and I think it's easier to do overall from the first person in a story that's voice driven, that just gives you a little snapshot of consciousness for a while. I've been trying to move more into the third person, which I think is more of a challenge because that's more novel territory.
Well, the other thing about third person is you can be in other people's heads at the same time. You can see things that a first-person narrator doesn't see.
That's right. You get that free indirect ranging through different consciousnesses.
The God view of everything.
The omnipotence. Yeah. But that, again, is so hard to do in a short story. If you've only got, 12,000, 15,000, you know, you've only got 8 or 10 pages,
What defines a short story? What's the limit?
That's an impossible, very good question. I think Saul Bellow got tired of wondering what was a short story, passing into a novella, passing into a novel, that I think a bunch of editors just got together and got a very good magazine now. I think it's published out of Fairleigh Dickinson, called The Long Story. So they couldn't find that gray area between that allowed for a definition between a short story and a novella. I'd say a short story is anything under 30 or 45 pages. Novella, you know, creeps up toward the 60s and 70s. And then you find novels as small as, especially in Europe, as small as, 120 pages. I must say I'm one of those people who, maybe I'm just inclined more toward the short form. I've written a novel, but I'm inclined more toward the short form. It's just, you know, I'm a lawyer by day, so I don't have as much time to work on a longer work. And I must say, I've seldom read a novel that I didn't think, including many classic novels, could have been shorter. My friend Jonathan Safran Foer said that to me once. It's not my expression of the idea. I always felt it. But he put it really well. He thought that there were just a handful of novels that were the right size. Mm-hmm. Almost all were longer than they needed to be.
Let me tell our listeners a little bit about you. You had a first book of linked stories entitled 100 Siberian Postcards that was very well received in 2007. You have had other stories and articles appearing in places like the LA Times, Playboy, Fiction Magazine, Chicago Review, and Penn Quarterly. you live in Southern California. You're not getting the best weather here in the summertime, but most Southern California
is lovely. It's been beautiful. So,
yeah?
It's been, in Seattle, it was sunny, and it was...
That's the way it was here yesterday. Yeah. Kicking In is your latest book. You were talking about most novels could be shorter. I've just finished reading all the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo novels, and this guy could seriously use an editor, but the thing is, the story was so powerful,
right,
and the characters were so compelling.
I've only read the first one.
And
what a story. I mean, the guy writes three, I mean, his own personal biography, he delivers three manuscripts and promptly dies
promptly
at 52.
Dies, yes. Unexpectedly, even for him, yeah. Maybe especially.
And then there was a question of foul play, and then they ruled that out because he was in some kind of political.
Well, he was a little like his protagonist, Michael Blomqvist, who was he was an investigative reporter and pissed a lot of people off. He was a lefty who was the editor of a Trotskyist magazine.
Right.
Yeah. So he was the kind of guy who didn't care. He speaking truth to power. He got up and yelled it in their faces.
Right.
Yeah. And the reason I bring that up is because the thing about a novel is that if the story is compelling enough and the characters are compelling enough and the situations are kinetic enough, then if the fact that the thing is a little too long or repeats itself from time to time seems to be that
forgivable.
Doesn't matter. Yes,
yeah, it's forgivable.
Whereas in a short story, you need to kick somebody in the guts and then go on to the next one.
That's right. Excess is always – once the reader is used to the scale he's working in, you know, as a reader in a short story, the waste rock that could be carved away from the marble in a short story is much, much more obvious. Whereas like, you know, in Anna Karenina, I forget Kitty's husband's name. It's like Lenin, but he's always doing these, you know, he's giving these agricultural disquisitions and things because at that moment, the wide-ranging interests of Tolstoy had landed there for a few months. And you know, that just rambles for a few pages, but you forgive it because all the rest of the novel is so tightly woven, and you need to know that he was a very loquacious guy, but you didn't need to know it quite that well. But you forgive Tolstoy. I don't think I've read a work of Tolstoy's that I felt was too long, even War and Peace.
Well, the thing about the say pre World War II novel, let's say that,
yeah.
Okay, because that seems to be the dividing line. It's what you have starting in the 19th century is a large group of literate people. Much larger than there ever has been in the history of humanity, because more people were going to school, even if it was just for grades, they could read. There was no radio, there was no TV, and evening's entertainment was reading a book.
Right.
Or a magazine. The magazines became very big in those days.
Yeah, and the books came out in magazines.
Books came out of magazines, serialized. So what you had was, this is what you did. You know, you burned the candle until the candle was gone, and then everybody went to bed.
Right.
You were reading Anna Karenina, or you were reading Little Dorrit, or whatever it was,
right,
because that's what you did.
Right. And it was it's fascinating, too, on the from an economic angle, from the writer's angle, that's those guys were living hand-to-mouth. People like, Dostoevsky and Dickens were delivering their manuscripts just in time to get the rent paid. I mean, until they were big, until, you know, somebody like Dickens was a big success on Fleet Street. But Dostoevsky, partly because he was had a gambling problem, was one step ahead. I mean, the wolf was at the door all the time.
And plus, a lot of these guys drank a bit.
They did. They were known to have a drop taken, yes, as Tobias Wolff likes to say.
Yeah, somebody once asked me why writers drink so much, and I say it's because they see humanity so clearly.
It's funny. There's a cartoon in the New Yorker that's got all the short stories in it. It says it's one of these Hamilton cartoons, and the woman's looking at this guy, and she's a magazine writer. And she goes, "So do you wine writers suffer too?"
Yeah, they suffer every time the bottle's empty. that's pretty funny. I haven't seen that issue yet, so I imagine
it's got a lot of good people in it. There's a lot of young. There's another thing I wanted to say is there's a lot of young short story talent that's tremendous. One of my favorite people now is a guy named Wells Tower, who wrote a book called Everything Ravaged, Everything Burned.
Is that a writer's name?
Yeah, isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
It's like a name out of Faulkner. I think he's from North Carolina, and the book is called Everything Ravaged, Everything Burned. And then there's this amazing woman from Kentucky who quit Harvard Divinity School to start writing short stories and wrote a novel, We the Living. Her name is C.E. Morgan, and she's in there. But most of the people are brand new that you see in that issue. Fowler's in it, mm-hmm. and a couple of other people whose names you would recognize, ZZ Packer. But it's mainly an intro issue with a lot of fascinating people.
Is it fair to describe the modern short story as all middle with no beginning and no end?
Yeah, although you can have stories that have a beautiful sense of closure that sort of kind of open in play and then shut just like a music box. But that's a fair characterization. It's a slice of time and a slice of consciousness.
Yeah, yeah. I used to describe the modern New Yorker short story as starting out with somebody peering out the window at the Hudson River and ending up exactly the same. In your book, Kicking In, a lot of the subject matter is extremely dark.
Yes.
You're a kind of a sunny person. I mean, as I talk to you here, you're a funny guy. You laugh a lot. Does this come from some deep part of your psyche or
probably.
What's going on?
Yeah. We have to talk to the shrink about that. But I can't afford
don't
the shrink
do that.
Anymore.
They'll charge you
hopefully
for that.
The book will
talk
do
to
that.
Me. Talk to us.
I think that that's one of the – obviously one of the devices is shock and dark subject matter. That it has a function of sort of narrowing the channels of attention. Whereas, again, with a novel, you need a more expansive and divergent approach. But, yeah, the stories are all the linking theme is narcotics. A lot of it has been kind of almost an overwritten subject, meth labs and so forth in the Inland Empire and in the Midwest where I come from. The OxyContin kind of pandemic, synthetic opiates.
Hillbilly heroin, as
exactly,
they call it.
Exactly, exactly, yeah. There's some DAs in some of those states that are trying to get that medication out of the entire state, which gives rise to interesting constitutional right to contract issues for the pharmaceutical companies. But one of the reasons for the darkness, I think, is that it's kind of almost a quotidian economic issue. Is it? It's you. To sell a short story collection these days, you have to have a linking theme.
Is that right?
You really do. Because publishers are so wary of short stories and poetry, they know that traditionally they don't sell. And in fact, now, most of the time, you have to do with a very big trade house like Viking or one of the Random House companies. They only offer to publish your short stories if it's linked to a novel, if it's a two-book deal. And then they give you the story collection as a sort of a pity gesture because they know they won't make money on
That's
it.
Pathetic.
There's a few exceptions to that. There are tremendous short story writers like Tobias Wolff who came out and just wrote such powerful, compelling stories right away. And then some of the great masters, some of my heroes, people like Alice Munro, the Canadian, who I think is probably the greatest living short story writer in English, and William Trevor, have always. Oh, Trevor wrote a novel or two, but those when you really hit the bullseye with the short stories very early in your career, you can keep doing that. I mean, Wolf told me once that his brother runs the writing workshop at UC Irvine. Knopf was bothering him and just jabbing at him to write a novel. And he wrote a good novel about his prep school, old school. But, you know, he can just write short stories forever because that's what people expect out of him. And he doesn't write any stinkers. They're all pretty great.
Let me remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Richard Wyrick. His last name is spelled W-I-R-I-C-K. Rick Wyrick. And the title of the book is Kicking In, published by Soft Skull Press. If I had a publishing company, I would definitely consider a name like that, the Soft Skull Press.
Yeah, it's an amazing little publishing company. It's an imprint of Counterpoint, and they've had some fabulous success. I was happy to see that a lot of the prizes went to small presses this year. We were at BEA launching this book. And it was nice to see that the Bellevue Literary Press, which literally was a literary review started by bored obviously fatigued, overworked medical interns.
At Bellevue, at NYU.
And that literary review then grew into a press, and there, one of their first novelists, a guy whose name escapes me, but the novel is called Tinkers, won this year's Pulitzer. And one of the other two runners-up for the Pulitzer for fiction was Lydia Millett's Love in Infant Monkeys, which is a soft skull short story collection. So it was a great year for the press, and they've been lovely to me. They're really great people.
It's funny. I was looking for a unifying theme. I had no idea that the unifying theme was chemicals of abuse. I saw the unifying theme as a clash between two points of view or two cultures, where at that interface things start to break down.
That's accurate. Yeah, sure.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Okay. I mean, that's a very fair. I mean, especially with the Amish story.
Where
the boy is helping. The English, as we're called, we non-Amish are called, and he sees everything from a biblical perspective, but then he's just completely bewildered when he's confronted with all the technology of the racing cars, and then he accidentally ingests the methamphetamine, the ephedrine powder, as he's cleaning out the barn, and has a drug experience when I'm sure he's never experienced anything stronger than iced tea, if that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's a lot of clash of culture, clash of background.
There's also a scary book about writer's block, a scary story, Undertow, about writer's block.
Yes, yeah.
Are you giving away anything there in that story about your own?
I've never really had writer's block. I've just had procrastination and laziness.
Oh, but, thank heaven! glad to hear I'm not the only one.
Yeah, so, that was Undertow. I was particularly proud of that story. It was in the CCNY journal that was started by Donald Barthelme and Mark Mirsky, fiction.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that story. I don't want to give away anything about these stories, but if you would like to discuss Undertow a little bit, feel free.
Yeah, it's really about a guy who is on the rebound from a relationship, and he meets a woman at an arranged dinner, one of those arranged dates, a dinner party held by his friends, and she's extremely inquisitive about him and vice versa. She knows he's a writer. She's a sort of raconteur dilettante. He invites her to, they let each other know that they at least smoke weed. And so they sort of have he has a day off and she has a day off from her job. And they go down through the Lower East Side, down through the Flatiron District, which is kind of my old stomping grounds. And is ironically the publishing center, really, in New York now. And they drift around and wander around, and he has some Dilaudid, and she very enthusiastically wants to try some. So they split a capsule, and she has a very kind of paranoid reaction to it, which is not a reaction you'd always have to a synthetic opiate like that. But she... it's hard to describe the rest without giving things away. She wanders off, becomes very suspicious of what he's up to. He's able, from the shock of seeing what's happening with her and his kind of crisis of responsibility that's been engendered by that, to go back and finish a story that he wasn't able to work on. And it kind of cured his writer's block. But he doesn't know what happens to her until the very end. And I can at least say that it's not something bad. Mm-hmm. It's a happy ending.
Yeah, which I guess that goes to the idea that the unexamined life is not worth living, but the unlived life is not worth examining. I mean, you actually have to get out there and do something, or otherwise you have nothing to write about.
Some of my favorite stories here are the ones that are set like in Africa, in North Africa during the 70s, mm-hmm. and involve sort of Midnight Express type. I've never seen that film, actually. But it's pretty
grotesque by modern standards.
But there's a story that I'm told is very much like that, and it was based on us almost getting busted in a Moroccan hotel by... you know, hotel concierge employees posing as police.
Oh, bro.
And it was during the war for the Spanish Sahara between Algeria and Morocco. So it was, and we had gotten the keef actually from an Algerian kid, which made it even more problematic because the Algerians were so hated by the Moroccans then. And then there's a story set in Somalia during our military efforts there in 92 and 93, which is my personal favorite. It was John Whitty published it down at the Northwest Review in Eugene, and then it became a BBC radio play. And that's a good example of how I think short story writers work. The incident in which a soldier is hit by a rocket-propelled grenade, a light tank weapon, that is a live round, it lodges under his skin and does not explode. And they take him on a medevac and they have to operate on him. And the doctors have to kind of do their medical duty and try to lift the thing out of him, but they don't know whether they'll drop it and blow the whole helicopter up. That was a single sentence. I got the idea from Mark Bowden's Black Hawk Down. He's the great war reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And in this, my main character is just one guy that was loaded onto the medevac with this subcutaneous live grenade in his sternum. And in Bowden, you know, the narrative arc of Black Hawk Down took its course, and you never knew what happened to the guy. Mm-hmm. So I figured, a writer just can't. He's got to imagine what happens with that guy and what the consequences will be.
Yeah, that's a harrowing, I guess, is the best way to describe
that
story.
Yeah, everybody's walking on eggshells. They're going to either be blown out of the sky or not.
There's I believe it's the last story in the book about a woman who is having a great deal of difficulty in her personal life with an autistic child.
Correct.
And starts abusing methadone. It shows you how naive I've become. I didn't even know that methadone was a drug of abuse.
Yeah, I think in rehab clinics, it can be kind of snuck out, and it's sold too. It's trafficked just like anything else.
I thought because the thing about methadone is you didn't get a buzz.
No, I don't know from personal experience, but you do enough for it to have a market.
Mm-hmm.
She gets it from her husband.
I know about Dilaudid because back in the 60s, junkies used to kill each other for a tablet of Dilaudid.
So, yeah, that's the great scene in Drugstore Cowboy, mm-hmm. where William Burroughs, my God, you gotta love Gus Van Sant, and it's such an honor to be in his city. it really is. When Burroughs takes, he's that defrocked junkie priest, and he says, and he has liquid Dilaudid, and he holds it up and he says, yeah, this is the stuff. This is as good as heroin.
A friend of mine who was a heroin addict told me that the difference between heroin and Dilaudid was 86 elephants, and I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, heroin is like an elephant sitting on your head, and Dilaudid is like 87 elephants sitting on your head.
That's funny.
Yeah. Have you ever tried a novel? Are you going to try
a
novel?
Yeah, no, I have a novel. It's being gone over by my English editor who edited my first book, Mitch Alpert, and that is also has a drug theme. It's about tweakers, meth makers, up in the Antelope Valley, northeast of where I live in Santa Monica, which is really kind of the center of the meth trade there. And then I'm working on it.
Right?
The Inland Empire also, Riverside County, and. The Antelope Valley and Fresno and the Central Valley, I remember when we adopted our baby daughter from Russia, which is what the first book is about, I rode back on the plane from Moscow to L.A. with a bunch of from Moscow to New York with a bunch of Midwestern United States attorneys. And they were big meth prosecutors, and they knew more about the streets and terrain and counties and geography of Central California than I would ever know. They were telling me all about where in Fresno they made their career-making busts and so forth. But it's an epidemic everywhere. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the meth. The recent folklore that the meth is very little is being made anymore in the United States. It's all being dragged in from Mexico.
That's exactly right. There was a great series by Ralph Quiñones in the L.A. Times about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because
it has a name, like one of the like Persian something, but it's
There's not a whole bunch of silly drug laws in Mexico to prevent you from getting huge barrels of ephedrine.
So, exactly. Yeah.
There's a lot of exotic locations here. North Central Ohio, that's pretty exotic to me. But it's also Lower East Side and the Upper East Side, Thailand, the Bay Area. Have you traveled to all these places? Do you have
I mean, I went to school at Berkeley, law school in Northern California. I grew up in Ohio. And then I kind of, you know, as an undergrad, when I could scrape the money together, I took the grand tours that sort of took me to northern, to Mediterranean Africa and Europe. Most of my other stories are have happier themes, and they're set in the Ohio of my youth. But again, there's not as much a market for that. There's got to be something that's a little lurid out there.
I don't know what that says about the human condition, but I'm not sure I want to think about it much.
Yeah, think about Baudelaire, for instance, why he was more popular than almost any French writer of the time. There's a tremendous attraction to darkness.
All happy families are the same. All unhappy families are unhappy in their own way.
Yeah. The greatest first line of any novel you've ever heard. I'm amazing.
Is that the greatest first line? Yeah, maybe it is. It's pretty close.
It's damn good.
It beats Call Me Ishmael. Let's put it that
way. Yeah, where you're just, what's
one more one more story I want to talk about. I'm almost sorry that there's no Alfred Hitchcock Presents on TV anymore, because The Way It Came would be a great Hitchcock story.
Oh, thank you. That's an Ohio story.
We've got about a minute. Tell us a little bit about that.
A good thing to talk about, because it's so interesting. I heard as a young lawyer a tape, a CHP tape, where a California Highway Patrol tape, where a guy had been. He was a bad deer hunter, obviously. He wasn't able to shoot a deer. I come from a family of deer hunters in Ohio. And so he of course, hits a deer with his car by accident, which happens, of course, all the time in the Midwest. He puts the deer in the back seat of his car because his trunk is full. And some people do this. And he doesn't have rope to strap it to the top. And the deer is alive, after all, and it begins thrashing, and its antlers go through and the back of the seat and puncture one of his lungs. And then I'll let the reader figure out the rest. But that actually happened, and I listened to the frantic call. It was from a phone booth.
It was a 911 call?
It was a 911 call from a phone booth, not a cell phone. It was 96. There were cell phones. But this guy was – and he lived. He was pretty badly wounded with lung punctures. But the thing came alive and thrashed around, and that's what happens in The Way It Came.
He was going to take it home and shoot it in the neck.
Yeah, he was going to take it home and make it look like – and show his brothers who were the champion deer hunters.
Where I come from, the word for that is schmuck.
Not a schmeckle.
That's a little one.
Okay.
Yeah. It's been fun talking to you. I've been speaking with Richard Weirich. Again, his last name is spelled W-I-R-I-C-K. Book of stories entitled Kicking In, published by Soft Skull Press. Now, I have to pin you down here. The next book of yours that comes out, I want to take a look at it. So if it's your novel, that's fine. If it's more short stories, you know, what the heck.
It'll be the novel. And I want to mention, I think I can do this. I'm going to read from the collection tonight at Powell's, the Hawthorne store.
You know,
Powell's Hawthorne.
I hate
at
to
7
tell
o'clock.
You this. I hate to tell you this, but this is being recorded and it probably won't get on the air for a month.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But in any case,
they always tell me to do that.
I should have warned you.
They say the DJ he'll forget. You got to mention it. So.
And I never forget anything. What were we talking about? Okay. Again, Rick, thanks very much for coming in, and I hope to see you again soon.
Great pleasure.